Today is a special edition of Earth Ancients with Daryl Miklos from the History Channel's Cooper's Treasure. This is a two-part series that features new information about an unexplained discovery beneath the waters of an area known as the Bermuda Triangle, outside of the Bahamas in the Atlantic Ocean. This program details what was discovered, what may change our understanding of the ancient past, our own history. You'll want to hear this a couple of times simply because the information is revelatory. It is unknown, hasn't been discussed before, and it also includes astronaut Gordon Cooper and his research as he orbited the planet in his capsule decades ago. All this today on Earth Ancients. Saturday, October 13th, this is a special edition of Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hello and welcome to another edition of Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. This is a special edition. This show chronicles the work of Daryl Miklos, who you may have heard about from the Discovery Channel, and his work with astronaut Gordon Cooper, who together went on a number of different expeditions around the Americas to uncover anomalous artifacts lost in time. You're going to hear from Daryl on just what he and Gordon discovered prior to his work as an explorer and his other discoveries of shipwrecks. This is our show today. I'm concentrating on the discovery made by Daryl Miklos and his team, but we are going to go beyond what has been shown on Cooper's Treasure, the Discovery Channel program, and what is discovered, what has been found, and the possible unknown civilizations in the Bermuda Triangle area. This isn't the first underwater research team that has found evidence of civilizations under the water. In the last couple of decades, a number of significant discoveries have been made. If the latest evidence is actually true and accurate, that perhaps 9 to 12,000 years ago, as a result of polar ice caps melting from an undetermined cause, of course, we've had people on the show that say that it was an asteroid hit that was hot enough to melt these ice caps. The results were water tables rising 3, 4, many hundreds of feet and covering land around the world. Underwater research is fairly new, and it's only been in the last few decades that significant discoveries have been made. In 1987, off the shores of Japan, the Yonaguni Jima ruins were uncovered, and this was discovered by a diver team, and this is a huge structure with perfectly cut terraces, walkways, and other features over 100 feet below the ocean. The massive structure has a base of over 250 feet and rises to a height of 80 feet. And I've spoken with Dr. Robert Schock, who has dove in that area, as well as others. In fact, I believe Greg Little dove there too, and it's man-made. This is a man-made structure of huge proportions. We don't know what the civilization was, but we do have an idea just how massive it is, and we've had it scanned, and there's a number of other researches that have basically determined that it's an artificial feature. In 2000, the marine engineer Pauline Zielinski and her husband Paul Weinzing were exploring off the Cuban coast and were startled to discover about 2,500 feet underwater buildings. She revealed in her imaging using a remote guided drone that there appeared to be columns, buildings, and even a pyramidal structure. They also discovered that the stones appeared to be smooth, as if they were polished. And Pauline even mentioned that the appearance was like granite. And nothing's come of this since that discovery. It's very strange that we haven't heard more about that, because I remember when it was discovered that the National Geographic was full on board to consider further explorations of this structure to see exactly what it was. So we haven't heard anything about that. Then in 2002, off the Gulf Coast of Cambay in India, the ancient city of Dwarka was discovered. This is the city, the lost city of Lord Krishna, that was a myth. It was a myth up until this point. Was discovered 150 feet or 36 meters under the water. Now, this is a fascinating discovery because not only did the sonar discover perfect streets, buildings, and other structures designed with a high level of accuracy, but some of the dating came back to over 5,000 years, and further testing has come back with some incredible dates that the city may be as old as 9,000 years old. We don't hear a lot about that because it really shakes up the historians, shakes up the archaeologists, and just basically throws a wrench into the whole historical notion. Today we're going to talk about the work of astronaut Gordon Cooper, what he revealed comes to full light. Now we get some sense of what happened in the series Cooper's Treasure, the painstaking research that he did as he was orbiting the planet for a record 122 hours. We'll learn that a good portion of his orbit was to track Russian activity, and the equipment he had on board was designed specifically to check anomalies on the surface of the planet, under the water. And this is where we get into some fascinating research. Today, we're going to hear firsthand what Daryl Miklos and his team uncovered 300 feet under the water. I made this a two-part series because it's really a two-part discovery. You're going to find in this first part what they thought they were going to discover based on these maps from Cooper, and the unexplained discovery that was made. Part two continues with that and also delivers some additional startling discovery that, in my estimation, changes our understanding of Earth's past. And this is what Earth Ancients is all about. So here's part one in its entirety, my conversation with Daryl Miklos, an unexplained discovery beneath the Bermuda Triangle. So for the last few weeks, we've been discussing the extraordinary discovery made by Daryl Miklos and his team at Gemini Marine Explorations. If you've been watching the Discovery Channel, you've seen the episodes called Cooper's Treasure. And this is an in-depth look at not only his relationship with Gordon Cooper, but also his work underwater, the different salvaging operations he does, and some unusual discoveries, which is part of our show today. If you don't know who Daryl Miklos is, he is was raised in a family that have a long history of successful underwater recoveries. And he and his father were constantly looking for different types of ships and underwater exploration. Later, his father met with Gordon Cooper. Together, they were doing research, but it was Miklos who actually cemented a relationship, and later they would do some research on their own. And today, I am really happy to have Daryl on the program. He is the expedition leader for Gemini Marine Explorations, and we're going to find out just what he discovered in an area known as the Bermuda Triangle. Hey, Daryl, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me, Cliff.
Great to have you on. Hey, let's start off by talking a little bit about underwater exploration. When we hear about underwater salvage, most of us think of Jacques Cousteau and Philippe, his son. You have kind of crystallized the information, the details of underwater salvage in this program, Cooper's Treasure. But when you guys actually do salvage work, it's a lot of lead time up to actually diving in the water, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's, in fact, that's a lot of things that people don't know. I'm actually putting together a YouTube show to describe those very steps that get you to actually diving in the water. It's not just as simple as go, hey, let's go put a bunch of boats in the water, grab a crew, and dive down on a particular site, find a shipwreck, bring up treasure, and you're off and running laughing all the way to the bank. It's hardly that at all.
Right. And I mean, it's expensive to plan a trip, to get your team together, to fly out, to get in a boat. And then the actual dive, it must be, extremely expensive to do that. And the rewards, I would think, are few, if any. You dive hoping to find something. And do you, always land on the mark, or is it more of a hit and miss?
Well, look, I'll be honest with you. Since we've opened up and tapped into the files that Gordon left behind, a few of these areas that we dove on were areas that Gordon and I worked on together. So it wasn't as though I was hoping that we would find something. I knew we would find something, but what it is that we would find was the question, because a lot of these things, we were basically, there wasn't one site that was visited by me and my crew that we didn't find a shipwreck.
Okay. So his work was very accurate then.
Extremely accurate. And then, that combined with some of the new material that we brought by doing our own research just aided in us finding a lot of shipwreck material. Finding shipwrecks with treasure is a different thing, because shipwrecks went down all over the Caribbean, especially in the Bahamas. But to find shipwreck material and then filter through that material and identify objects that will lead you to real treasure is the key to success. And I have the right team to do that. The thing is it takes time and it takes lots of money. And the show, at least season two, the emphasis was just about how difficult it was to be under the gun and only have 8 weeks and a budget for 8 weeks and nothing more, and to have to find something that had treasure on it so that I could continue this mission. And it was a really hard thing to do. And it was live. It was real. It was, we could have come up with nothing, and then that would have been the show as well.
But, okay.
Luckily, it turned out the other way.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about this fascinating discovery in a little bit. But so they had an expectation for you to actually find something then.
Right. Well, everybody was expecting us to find something. Obviously, everybody wanted us to find tons of treasure. The thing is it took Mel Fisher. He's a very famous treasure hunter in the southern Florida Keys near Marquesas Key, near the closest to Key West, Florida. Mm-hmm. It took him 16 years to to find the mother lode. And so he was just finding pieces of the wreckage for 16 years before he finally struck it big. We had 8 weeks. Even if we have the right maps and the right charts that more or less put an X on the spot, you still have to filter through that material. The bottom has changed over the last half century. So that's the difference.
And okay.
It's very difficult.
I want to talk about your relationship with Gordon Cooper. And can you talk a little bit about your relationship as a younger person? You were with your dad, and Gordon and your dad became friends. Did he go with you and your dad on different expeditions, or how did he kind of integrate into your life?
Well, how it went down was in the late 60s, my dad wanted to become a treasure hunter. He got sick as a police officer, and he was really ill. And so my mom brought him a book about treasure hunting, thought it would be interesting. Once he read that book, he goes, "I got to meet that guy." It was a gentleman named Kip Wagner, who, for pure accident, found a shipwreck filled with gold and silver right off his house on the beach, now called the Cabin Wreck.
Oh, boy.
And he was very good friends with Gordon Cooper. Through that meeting, he met Gordon Cooper. And then eventually, fast forward about 10 years, 8 years, they did a television show called The Merv Griffin Show. And my father, from that point on, was good friends with Gordon Cooper. They both were guests on that show.
Okay.
On the Merv Griffin Show in March of 1978. I was in the green room in the back watching the show, and my dad introduced me to Gordon Cooper at that time. So that was the first time I had met him, and I was 15.
Right.
So I hadn't seen much of him between 15 and 35. I'd seen him come by the house, and he would stop by and look at my dad's treasure. They would do their talk. But I was a kid. My dad basically said, "Go away, kid. You bother me." Yeah. That's the kind of guy my dad was. That's exactly who he was. You know? And so I was pushed aside. And it wasn't until I started getting older that my dad, you know, kind of accepted me as part of his business. And when I met Gordon, I was so awestruck. And luckily, in 1997, my dad had asked me to go to the Bahamas with him. And he said, "Daryl, remember Gordon? Can you pick him up at the airport and then fly into the Bahamas with him?" And that's when we started really bonding. We went there to look for we went there to get a lease in the Bahamas. We were unsuccessful at the time because the moratorium had just been made law, so they weren't allowing salvage to come in there. We were on the list of one of the groups to be first to be permitted to salvage there, but still it was very difficult. So we went back to California together. My dad went his way, and I had made such a good bond with Gordon. He goes, "So what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm going back to California." And I was explaining to him what I was doing. I had a boat manufacturing business at the time. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to. I'm looking for an office." He goes, "Well, why don't you just come to my office? I got some room." And I went, "Are you serious?" And he goes, "Yeah." So that was it. We ended up sharing an office.
Where was his office? In L.A. or somewhere?
It was in Van Nuys Airport.
Ah, okay. So at that time, was he just a casual acquaintance, or was he starting to reveal his interest not only in salvaging old ships, but just anything to do with his expeditions in the air, his orbits as a astronaut?
Well, see, when we went to the Bahamas, that's when he brought us the sea chart, or where we coined treasure map from space.
Okay.
He brought that to the office in the Bahamas, said, "That's the area. There's the wreck site. X marks the spot." And I was going, "How did you get all those markings on this chart?" And then he explained us the story that he was up in space and on a mission during Mercury 9 to locate potential nuclear threats from the Cold War at the time, because it was a Cold War at the time. So he was looking for those. And he also had been a treasure hunter prior to his first flight. So years before that, he was a treasure hunter. Wow. And so he knew what he was looking for. So he identified things, and there were tracking stations that tracked the capsule as it flew along its flight path. And when he would pick up an anomaly or an area that looked interesting, he would jot down that via the tracking station. I'm not sure which numbers that he got, but they gave him numbers so he could pinpoint his location mm-hmm. and whatever it was he was looking at, because obviously they had to be able to do that somehow, because if he identified a nuclear threat, he had to be able to tell them exactly where it was. So he did the same thing when he saw something interesting that caught his eye or his attention and jotted that down and came back to Earth, got together with it after all the accolades of the successful space flight, you know, and he set all sorts of records on that flight. I mean, this was an amazing man, single man voyage for 3 days, 122 orbit. It's amazing. Right. 122 hours is amazing. And then he came back down, got together with his friends, said, "Hey, look, this is what I found in space." So he grabbed Kip Wagner, the guy my dad met back in the late 60s, and he said, "Let's go look out for some of these shipwrecks." And that was the one that we were focusing on season two, mm-hmm. the last show, this year's show.
Let me ask you about his in space orbits. Now, it's described on the show that he was, you know, looking for, features, rockets, metallic shapes, things like that. What did he have on board that is described as being able to detect these things? Did he just tell you anything about what kind of technology they had loaded on that capsule?
He did. He said there was a crude version of a magnetometer. Now, there's a lot of people that are trying to debunk that part of the storyline. Hmm. I mean, they call it storyline. I call it reality. They try to debunk that ever existed, but it did exist. There were DOD experiments that took place
in space.
And in fact, I think you'd have to be foolish to believe that the U.S. government was going to do set up NASA and not somehow control it or be involved. It was to control space was the ultimate goal of any country at that time.
So he actually described to you a magnetometer which can detect magnetic anomalies. Yeah. It was a very crude. So it must have been fixed on the capsule nose, and then he had some kind of a reading that showed up on his dashboard.
In season one, we talk about Mercury 8, they had used a telescope, and it was fitted inside a capsule. Okay. They removed that telescope for Mercury 9 and stuck a crude version of a magnetometer and tethered it behind the space capsule because it would pick up the magnetic readings of the space capsule. So they had to run it on tether behind them and run experiments. And the Russians were experimenting with this in 1957. Uh-huh. To say that the Americans weren't doing it in 1963 would be ridiculous. There's proof of this. So that technology was used. Plus, he had the top of the line camera equipment. And he also had 2010 vision. That coupled with camera equipment and his ability to see things from space. I visited Eastman Kodak in Buffalo, New York, just recently. Talked to the gentleman there. In fact, part of that was on the show in season two, where he talks about the special cameras that they built for the DOD and Department of Defense, and that these cameras were, you know, they could see things that no one else could see. You could see a guy that he even mentions it in one of the clips that the Russians and Americans claimed that they could see people smoking a pipe on the ground. They could focus in that close. Wow. So this stuff was way ahead of its time back then. There was even a crude version of a digital camera Gordon told me about back then, which I found fascinating. And everything that Gordon told me, I was a wholehearted believer in it. And there's other reasons that make me not doubt, because that's the small stuff. If I told you everything that he told me about what went on behind those four walls in NASA, it would blow your mind.
No, we have had a lot of doctors of different types of fields, nuclear physics, plasma physics, talking about some of the NASA goings on. We've had even some of their top image specialists on the show, And there's a lot of cover-up going on, a lot of cover-up. So anything you said, I'd love to hear about it, but it sounds like you're gonna lock me out a little bit.
How about this? We get to know each other a little bit better, and I'll kind of reveal it. That's what Gordon did to me. It wasn't okay. Like he just unleashed all this information at me at one time.
Yeah, so. No, I totally get you, and we'll definitely see what happens. But this is a question, and maybe you can shed some light on this. He must have been a real bright guy, because if you got a reading coming up that is an anomalous piece of metal or some structure underwater that's showing up on your screen, you got to pull out your chart, you got to identify where it is, and maybe throw a few bearings of where it's actually located on a map, so that when he gets back on the ground, he can figure that out. It seems to me that he was very, very swift and able to do this, because in the actual series, he's showing, and you're showing these maps with great detail on them.
Yes, yeah, so he didn't have those charts up in space with him.
Okay.
What he did was he had a notepad. Oh, my God, if you saw the notepads and the notes that Gordon took, how meticulous he went and wrote things down during his day, every day. He would talk about, I went and picked up Carol a nasal spray at such and such pharmacy at 12 p.m. I returned to the house at 12:35, handed her the nasal spray. That's how detailed he was. So he brought a little notepad and jotted down what it was that he was seeing. He had really good bearings as to where he was in space and went over which part of the Earth and geographical locations that he could identify with. Plus, he had a camera right there.
Yeah.
Would take a photograph of the camera, jot down the time he took that photograph, compare that photograph later with what he was looking at, got a number on it from the tracking stations, and those numbers he could acquire later or at the moment, however he did it. He just took notes. Then he went back to Earth after all the accolades, put together this very large C chart, and jotted everything down. And not only did he do it on Mercury, he did it on Gemini as well.
Okay, so the question I have is, how did he get through the security or whatever, or is this just a sign of the times he was able to take these notations home with him?
And everybody brought stuff. They brought personal effects with them. He brought a piece of eight from the 1715 treasure fleet with him up in space. Everybody was allowed to bring some personal effects, bring it back to Earth and say, this flew with me in space on such and such a mission.
Oh, okay.
He just had a notepad with him. And then he had the camera that he was using to take pictures of potential nuclear sites. He just goes, okay, I know where this is. He made a note which area he was going to take a photograph of. He would photograph up, take a note, go southernmost reef on southeastern tip of Cat Island, let's just say. Cat Island, he knows where it is. He looks on the picture and goes, oh, there it is. And then he finds the coordinates, Loran reading, put it all together, went down and investigated it later. It's not rocket science, even though it is, kind of.
Now, does he basically tell you that within the 122 hours of that orbit, that was his primary objective, was to track all these potential sites?
No, it wasn't. His initial his initial mission was what he went up there for on behalf of the United States government. And that was to protect U.S. interest on behalf of the Department of Defense under the auspice of NASA. But while he's up there, every single astronaut did something personal while they were in space. And so while he's there, he's going, my God, I've got this camera equipment. I'm told to take hundreds of photographs, if not thousands of them, while I'm up here. He's carrying a silver piece of eight from the Treasure Coast right there. Off the coast of Florida, and he's looking at the Bahamas, and he's going, oh my God, I know what's out here, because he studied remember, he was passionate about this before he went up. So he already knew which routes they were taking, the thoroughfares, the Gulf Stream. He was very well aware of that. So why not just use the same photographs that he turned into NASA and go, I know that island. I see something here. He looks down and he goes, he identified several reefs from space. He said he could see ship wreckage right on those reefs, and he knew, I'm going to jot that down. Wow. And he knew the names of the islands as he was flying over them, and he just would go and take photographs of those islands and then jot down the location and visit those sites later. Like I said, it wasn't what he had planned to do. But it wouldn't surprise me if he was thinking to himself, my God, if I get a chance and I'm flying over the Florida and the Bahamas, I think I'm going to take me some photographs and see if I can see something from space. And once he really was able to, when he realized that, oh my God, I can see stuff, then he started jotting this down, because he made several orbits over around the Earth. He had time to, well, if he missed it the first go around, he'd come back on the next go around and take pictures. And that's how he did it. That's what he told me.
Did he talk about actually after his flight in space, did he talk about actually going out and maybe checking out some of the ones that were most prominent, or maybe someone that he felt that he could see without having a great deal of effort?
Absolutely. Of course. That's the first thing he did. There were 10 anomalies out of about 60 that he put on the chart that he identified shipwreck material that he said he could see from space. Mm-hmm. He made a huge discovery in 1969 based on shipwreck material that he saw from space off the coast of Veracruz, Mexico, in the Gulf of Mexico. Upon his visit with one of his astronaut friends and Kip Wagner going down and looking for the shipwreck, they identified the shipwreck material, so they knew that they had it. The pilot that flew them there in a seaplane took off because the bull sharks started attacking the plane, and the guy panicked, and he abandoned them right there on that island. Oh, boy. So not that on that coastline. So they had to walk to the coast. They flagged a farmer down that was grazing corn on a cliff near the sea's edge or the land's edge closest to the ocean. But it was a Mayan, and he couldn't really speak that good of Spanish, but Gordon spoke a little bit of Spanish, and they finally got that guy to get them help. In the meantime, Gordon was going, by the way, what are those mounds that you're growing corn on? And he said, those are tunnels, caves. And he said, well, do you mind if we go and investigate those? And he goes, don't go in there. You're not allowed to go in there because there's evil spirits in there. He goes, well, look, do you mind if we go in anyway? And the mind says, at your own risk. However, they were having a conversation. They managed to go and visit those three caves. And inside there happened to be one of the largest discoveries ever made in Mexico, the Olmec civilization. Prior to his discovering that, which he may have picked up those readings from the magnetometer, he may have just identified the shipwreck material just off the coast there, because Veracruz was a very famous port where the Spanish would take the silver and gold from Mexico City, leave the port of Veracruz, and head back to Spain.
Right.
For various reasons, he could have identified that particular site. But when he found out it was filled with three caves filled to the brim with golden artifacts, jade, all sorts of fantastic burial ornaments and things of that nature. And he reported that to the Mexican government. They gave him accolades. And by the way, I have photographs of this whole thing. He gave all of that to the Mexican government. The president of Mexico at that time said, look, for giving this to Mexico, I will allow you to open up your shirt, grab as much of the gold that you can see in those caves, put it in your shirt and take it with you. As much as you can carry, we will let you have, and that's our way of saying thank you to you. Gordon said, no, I'm going to donate all of this to Mexico. And then the governor and the president of Mexico said, well, look, come back in 6 months. We're going to set up a museum. So he did, and they went back and set up a museum there. And then they did some research on it. Some archaeologists did some research and some carbon dating or whatever they used back then to identify the age. And they deduced that these artifacts were one of the oldest artifacts, if not the oldest artifacts ever found in Mexico at that time. And it was from a civilization, not Incas, not Mayan, not Aztecs, not Mayans, but Olmec.
And do you have a rough time frame, what year that was? Or
1969.
Wow. That's amazing. Fantastic.
That was a huge discovery. Not only that, but he discovered the location of the Atocha and the Santa Margarita that was later found by Mel Fisher Today's value is about $800 million. Back when he discovered it in 1985, it was valued at about half a billion dollars, $500 million. And Gordon identified that area from space and jotted it down on the chart. And I will give you a laundry list of a whole bunch of others, which I'm still looking for, that were on that chart that were verifiable. So this is not like I'm wondering if he was right. Everything he ever told me, he was right. I wouldn't have enough time in 100 lifetimes to search all the areas that he plotted on that chart.
That's amazing. On your website, in your bio, it describes that you and Gordon in 1997 set out to do a recovery project in the Bahamas. What was that first project?
That was the one that season two was about, the last show.
Oh, okay.
That's the one. That was why I went there. That was the first place that I went with Gordon to look for shipwreck material.
Okay. And why don't you just give us a couple of highlights? Because I didn't see that program. Is it a specific ship you're looking for?
It was information relating to the Sir Francis Drake and the Golden Hind. Now, everybody knows the Golden Hind made it back to England, but there were several Golden Hinds. Every ship that Sir Francis Drake used, he called the Pelican and or the Golden Hind. And then based on that information, Kip Wagner went down to that area. This is one of the main areas he saw from space. I was looking for something related to the Golden Hind and found a solid gold table. He hoisted the gold table up with a winch that he had on a rented boat. And when he lifted it up onto the boat, he started getting super excited. And also when he went down there and identified it, he noticed that there were cannons and anchors and cannonballs and other shipwreck material associated with that gold table. When he put it on the boat and he started heading back to the dock, which was at least 20 miles away, he realized, my God, if I take this gold table off this rented boat at a dock, what the hell am I going to do with it? Somebody's going to steal it. They're going to think I stole it. So he went and he put it back in the water and buried it. And he told Gordon the story. Gordon hand wrote a letter to me and my dad at the time when we were there in the Bahamas trying to get that lease I told you about. He handed us a letter, showed us the treasure map from space, and said, that's the shipwreck that I would go after first. So that's what we did when and then he died in 2004. Kip Wagner died in 1972, so they never even got a lease, he and Kip, back in the late 60s, because Kip had really bad heart problems, and he died in 72. And then Gordon never went back there except for with us in 97. And then we were unsuccessful. And here I am, fast forward 2018.
Yeah, fascinating. I want to touch on a couple of areas simply because I have a great interest in the Yucatan Peninsula. Have been there many, many times. I do tours down there with people on the program here. You mentioned in your bio that you and Gordon took trips to Campeche, Yucatan, other parts of Mexico on expeditions. What did you actually track down there? Or what did Gordon track while he was in space that would make you go down there?
Well, I don't want to give an exact location, but in those areas that you just mentioned, especially near the ocean or in the Gulf, we located, he had several anomalies there. So what we did is I happened to set up a business in the state of Campeche. I befriended the governor of that state. I introduced Gordon to the governor about something else, about the business that I was running. I had a boat manufacturing facility down there. Gordon was my hydrodynamic specialist. And then after introducing him to the governor went, wow, you're amazing. You're an astronaut. And then we started talking about the history of that city, Campeche.
Yeah.
And Gordon says, it's amazing down here. And he goes, oh, yeah, you see, you're a treasure hunter. Oh, my God. And the governor pushed open a secret door in his office, and it was filled with all these treasure and artifacts that he had collected diving in the water. And then Gordon says, oh, my God, Daryl, we need to sit down and talk with these guys. So we tried to get a license to do salvage in that part of the world. So the governor even loaned us his airplane, and we put a magnetometer on it, drug it behind the airplane as we flew over, scraping the waters nearby. And we found 136 anomalies. Out of those, we found about 35 shipwrecks that we believe were treasure-laden shipwrecks in that area. Okay. And that's what Gordon and I did. That's what we were doing. And then we also went to the Yucatan and investigated a lot of the Mayan ruins together. So that's what we did.
Did you guys come – I mean, because I'm fascinated. I think the whole Mayan history is completely wrong. I believe that there's a lot of offshore evidence of ruins that are under the water simply because the water rose many thousands of years ago. But exactly. did he ever come up with anything like that, or was it more just for shipwrecks?
Well, look, we were on a mission at the time because the governor of the state was loaning us airplanes and giving us all the help we wanted to go down there. So we're looking for shipwrecks, and then we are also really enthusiastic about the area, the region, because of the Mayan culture and the history there. After that, we started talking about other things. Gordon, too, believed that there was a lot of cities that were underwater, that the water table just rose. So there's a lot of land that's underwater. And so kind of like where you were going into your thought there, there's cities probably underwater that have yet to be discovered or have been discovered, and people are still trying to deduce what they are and what their origin is.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Gordon passed away in 2004. You continued his work. In 2014, you established your own company to continue his research. And today, that's what you do, right? That's pretty much what you're doing, is to salvage known and perhaps unknown shipwrecks based on his coordinates. Is that, would you make that a good assessment?
Yes, I would say that in general terms, yes, and some of the stuff that we worked on together while he was still alive. So yes, but the majority of it is based on his coordinates.
Okay, great. Let's jump to episode 7 and your dive in the Caribbean. What was the circumstances around that specific dive?
Well, there was on the chart that Gordon drew out. The chart's one thing. If you have this big sea chart with a bunch of circled areas and there was only a couple X marks of spots on that, you wouldn't be able to find treasure by looking at that chart. If I gave you that chart, you're going to go, wow, that's like a million square miles of water. Yeah, it is. Good luck with that. But what was important was the files that went with that chart. And the files, you see, those certain circles were numbered. Some of them, the numbered circles, the areas that he circled, were the most important and had files attached to it. So if there was a circled area that covered maybe 150,000 square miles of water and he numbered it number 2, then I would go and look through his files and find area number 2 and all the information that he discovered in that. Well, in one of the areas that he circled, which is... there were files attached to that area, and it said shipwreck location here, and he gave us a year and a name of a ship. Mm-hmm. And then when he's identifying shipwreck locations, and sometimes he would name the ship, sometimes he would date it, sometimes he would just do hand-drawn illustrations. In this case, he drew a hand-drawn illustration, and it said unidentified object. That was it. And I thought, okay, whatever. I figured – maybe he was talking about another shipwreck that he just hadn't identified, because a lot of these shipwrecks were just dated, not necessarily named. So I just thought that was another one. So we went down there looking for two shipwrecks that supposedly from the early 1800s, late 1700s, that landed right on top of sunk right on top of each other. Hmm. When we went down in the submarine, because the water was so extremely clear, and we were taking a break on our journey from the north to the south, having been going through the Bermuda Triangle, we figured this would be a good opportunity to try out the sub. And when we go down there, we said, you know what, there's two shipwrecks that supposedly sank here, so why don't we go ahead over there? When we went to that particular area, that's when we identified these objects that at first glance, they look like the mast of a ship sticking horizontally out of the side of a reef.
Well, let me stop you right there. Okay, so you had planned to find a ship.
To find ship, two of them, yeah.
Two ships, right. So what was the equipment that you went down for? And by the way, what's the depth we're talking about? How deep?
290 feet.
290 feet. And you had a submarine, one of these two-man submarines?
Yeah, two-man submersible that has the ability to go down to 1,000 feet.
Okay.
And for 8 hours.
Okay.
Yeah, so we decided we would go down there and see if we could identify this ship's wreckage. And normally I wouldn't do this because I don't deal in deep water wrecks. I'm a shallow water salvager because it's just easier and less expensive. But we figured it'd be a good opportunity to try out the sub because the water was so beautiful. The waters were super calm that day. Okay. And when we went down there, that's when we made this discovery.
Okay.
We never found the ships though.
So you never found the ships, but the first thing you landed on were this anomalous whatever it is. So you didn't find the ships. So you get down on top of this craft, and when you come up to it, what do you say? What do you think it is?
Well, at first we're thinking it's masts that have been encrusted with coral. But the water is very difficult to decipher exactly how large something is, especially when you're sitting in a sphere because it's magnetized. So you're thinking that you see something that's bigger or smaller, or you probably think that it's probably a lot smaller and it's just being magnified or whatever to make it look huge. But as we made our approach, we realized just how long these things were. They're about 35, 40 feet long. There were five arms sticking out of a wall. And we're thinking to ourselves, God, is that cannon? Why? How could cannon be sitting horizontally? Wait a second. They made cannon that big back in those days. And it had to have been really, 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 really old for that much coral growing over it. So we knew that the structure below the coral growth had to have been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And that's when it struck out. Wait, it can't be thousands of years. They didn't have shipwrecks back then.
Oh, so that got your mind going when you started calculating how old that coral was.
Yeah, there's no way that much coral could grow. Because look, we've been around a lot of coral. I've seen elkhorn coral grow that's probably 10,000 years old. It grows in the same spot. It after it gets so large, 30, 40 feet long on each side, it falls, and then the next level grows. And I've seen 10,000 years worth of elkhorn coral in one area where people just don't venture. So that's why it's still there. And I thought this was a similar situation. But then I'm going, but wait a second. That elkhorn coral hasn't fallen. And it's weird because it's a Gulf Stream. So there's a constant 5-knot current, if sometimes even 10-knot current in that area. And this is one of the other reasons we had to use a sub, because there's no way we would be able to swim through that. Eventually, we did send some divers down, and they dove utilizing some scooters, electric scooters, very powerful ones. But when we swam by these things in the sub, we realized just how big they were. And then we realized that there were five identical, maybe not identical, but five of the same shaped rectilinear objects protruding horizontally out of a very deep wall. If you'd have continued down the wall, you'd go down to 3,000 feet. But so there's five of them sticking out one side. Then as we took the sub to the other side, we found out there were five more over there. And in three areas, three identical type situations. And then that's when we realized this isn't normal. Something's growing under that coral. But we're not – it didn't look – look, I'm going to just say it as it is. It didn't look like a spacecraft because – and we didn't right away go, God, that's a spaceship. No, that's not what we thought. But we know that it had to have been man-made, or at least we believed it to have been man-made, because it didn't look like anything we'd seen in nature. Then we saw a very large ring. I don't know if you've ever seen the game that the Mayans played. They had this ring sticking out of a wall inside of an arena.
Oh, and yeah, they're ball games, sure.
Yes, they would use their hips to hit the ball through the hoop.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, we saw those hoops, I mean, perfect circles sticking out of this wall, encrusted with coral. But these circles were about 8 feet tall, 8 feet in diameter. Huge, but they were too perfect to have been nature made. I've seen a lot of weird things made by nature that, you know, almost confuse you, and you go, God, that's got to be something man-made. And you get up to it, and you go, nope, that's not. Mm-hmm. And these definitely weren't. So immediately we started thinking, there's something under there. We don't know what it is. It's some sort of structure. We're not really sure. And then we just kept on going around the area, and we saw some other stuff.
So give me, if you can, and we've talked offline about this, Daryl. When I saw these photographs in a number of online magazines, I just came up with the term superstructures. Like on an aircraft carrier, there's a superstructure that comes up out of the flatbed. What was the approximate size of these protrusions?
They were 15 feet at the shortest and 35 feet at the longest. I mean, I think the ones on the edges were 15 to 20 feet long. But then again, you really don't know what's underneath there. Maybe the coral actually did grow and it made it even longer. But they looked like the size of guns on a large battleship.
Okay, so they're not small at all. They're pretty good size.
And the way they were placed, and you know, so we're not really sure what's underneath that coral.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of the images look like exhaust chimneys or something. There's perfectly square. One image has perfect square. Do they all look about the same? Like they're
different. They're a little bit different. I mean, for the most part, they look the same, but for based on the type of coral growing on them, the shapes look a little bit different. They vary a little bit. But see, the thing that came to my mind right away was it wasn't a spaceship. And I'm not going to say that it was. I also am not going to say 100% that it's not associated with something otherworldly. But I'm going to say 100% that I'm not going to tell anybody what I think it is until actually we go down there and complete the scientific investigation of that area, gather more data, use some really cool technology to try and, you know, suck the ocean out. So I don't know if you've seen that 3D type of modeling. And we'll be able to see what's down there or get a better idea of what's down there. But first thing that came to my mind is this is another civilization, undiscovered civilization, very similar to what Gordon found off the coast of Veracruz. And I truly believe that. I believe that there are old ancient civilizations that are now underwater. And so this made the most sense to me. You know what I mean?
Okay. Would you say that if you could have touched the bottom with your craft, that this object is sunk in many feet, like 10 feet, 20 feet, maybe more?
Into the wall of the reef?
Into the surface of the – or the actual the surface, the ground, what we would call ground.
It's part of the ground or the
– Oh.
Actual, it's almost like it's part of it. So I'm not really sure, because if we're talking about something that's 290 feet deep, and if it's a man-made structure or man-made object, that area of the world or that area, that reef, for that to be exposed as if it were landmass would have to be at least 14 to 16,000 years old. So it makes sense that it's stuck to the side of the hill, whether it's a part of a structure that fell over or if it was intentionally supposed to be built horizontally on the edge of it. Because if you lifted that out of the water and made a landmass out of it, it would be a mountain with things sticking out the side of it. It would be cliffs on the side of the sea with things sticking out the side of it. Maybe a structure of some sort. We don't know what that structure is. And these rings, we don't know what they are. And they may be so old that if we take samples, we'd be able to see something and see what it's made of. And
okay,
we don't know. There's not enough information to say exactly what we think it is.
But that submarine had a lot of flexibility to move in and around these structures. Did you notice any doors or windows or any?
No.
Okay.
Nothing like that. You're in the dark for the most part. It's not dark, but you don't have, and we did have floodlights. What we did see is it just really large, unusually shaped objects that just could not just be coral alone. based on our knowledge of how nature forms coral. And coral cannot grow horizontally that long, 35, 40 feet long, some of the longest ones, horizontally in an area where you're in a Gulf Stream. So Gulf Streams have been there longer than that land has. Mm-hmm. So that Gulf Stream's been going through there. There's no way coral could grow horizontally unless there was a substructure underneath that coral. So something's underneath that coral. It did not grow horizontally. At least that's what we believe. Now, what's underneath that coral is we don't know yet, but mm-hmm. something's under there. And if it's something man-made, then we'd like to figure out what it is. If it's something made by something not man-made, then, you know, I would love to be able to find that and prove that. But
yeah,
until we actually undergo full study of the area, I'd never make that claim 100%. You know, I mean...
Is the object of a certain dimension that you could lift it out of the water if you had the right kind of a crane or a...
No, it'd be way too big.
It's just huge, huh?
It's enormous. It's not, and we don't even know if it's one object or pieces of multiple objects all in one area. You know what I mean? Because it's got natural reefs growing all over it, so it's hard to decide what it is. And it's only because it's on the edge of what I would call a former cliff that these circles, these rings that are sticking out the side of the cliff, along with these rectilinear objects sticking out, I don't know what it is. I'm totally confused.
Let me ask you this, and your co-pilot, I heard a clip, and he's kind of going, "Oh my God." You're both saying, "Oh my God," in the episode. What is this? If you kind of, can sense something, you know, you sense if it's a normal structure, man-made, whatever. If you were to sense, have a sense of this, an intuition of it, what would you say? What would you say you're looking at?
My gut feeling is it's probably some ancient civilization there. That's my gut feeling. Mm-hmm. Because I would love to be able to say it's something otherworldly, but that I can't go that far just yet, because I've seen, based on what Gordon's told me, you know, he was a big believer in the lost city of Atlantis. Now, the origins of the lost city of Atlantis, whether that's from other worlds or something, I don't know. I could go into tell you stories that Gordon told me. Again, I told you we'll just take our time with this as a release more information, but if I was Gordon, I would probably believe something fantastic. But again, Gordon was also a man who was not going to say something unless he could prove it. But I can tell you one thing. If Gordon was there with me at that moment, I think he would have been very pleased as to what we discovered, because it's something that he would hope to have discovered.
Okay. Is there any way for you to identify or have a sense of what type of material this anomalous...
We'd have to take a core sample.
But could you see a reflection, metallic or anything?
No. Again, like I said, this is something that we would – there was other things that we found that gave us evidence, and I don't know if you wanted to talk about that now, but there gave us the clues as to what we think it may be.
Mm-hmm. We're moving on to other discoveries in our next interview. But, I just want to get as much from you. I know, now you are going back. Is it March of next year? You're going to go back and dive in the same area.
Yep.
Okay, and that's going to be with Discovery Channel.
No.
Independent.
This is independent, and if somebody wants to help us film it, fantastic. But this is totally independent, and I trust me, I plan on filming it. But I don't think it's a Discovery thing.
Okay. Because this is what you might consider researching the anomalies.
Exactly. This is the other files, as we call it, of course.
Well, what was the show called? X-Files. It's an X-File.
Yeah. Well, this is Files of the Third Kind from Gordon.
Exactly. Hey, Daryl, this has been fun. This is the first part of our two-part interview. We have some more eye-opening discussions on what else that was discovered, what else was found, at the bottom of this area. Can you, without giving away, obviously, the location, this was deep in the heart of the Bermuda Triangle area, or was it just about outside of it?
Oh, it's within the Bermuda Triangle.
Okay. And have you personally experienced any strange anomalous readings on your equipment or anything like that as you've been in that area?
Three different locations, once in an airplane and twice on a boat.
Oh, really? So you actually had these magnetic anomalies show up?
Yeah. Funny enough, not when we located this particular site, but and you know what? We go through the Bermuda Triangle all the time and not have anything go wrong. But I've gone through the Bermuda Triangle where all of a sudden, what in the heck is going on? Dials are spinning, nothing's working, radios are off, everything just down. It just like shut down. It's like all of a sudden it blackout.
Wow.
And then it comes back and back to normal. And you go, what in the heck did that?
Well, let me ask you, while we're on the subject, was there any odd readings when you were close to this vehicle, this anomalous structure?
Yeah, just the sound of my heart going through my chest.
That was you flipping out going, what the hell?
I'm telling you, there's this. Hey, look, if you'd have seen it, it's just something that I love the unexplainable. And it just, to know that the majority of the things that we're pretty good at identifying Mother Nature made objects. We're really experts at identifying shipwreck material. We're a lot less experts at identifying stuff that makes no sense.
Wow.
So amazing. We just have to, but we, since we, this is the field with which we work in, we're probably the best qualified to go down there and study this area. And with the technology today, thank God, because had this been found 40, 50 years ago, even 30 years ago, there's probably not a whole lot you could do apart from taking some sort of sample.
Yeah.
Technology is so much further advanced that there's a lot of things we could do to figure out what exactly is laying on that very large mound.
Is this scanning technology you're referring to?
There's scanning, there's radar, there's ground penetrating radar that you use underwater. There's side scan sonar. There's all sorts of equipment. There's 3D modeling where you could it's really hard when you're underwater to visualize what something is. And there's 3D imagery where you can almost like drain the ocean and you can kind of identify it. And then you just take a step back and you zoom out and you go, oh my God, it's so obvious. Now I know what it is.
Yeah.
That stuff.
I have to ask you, Daryl, and I don't know how you feel about this, but if you have discovered something significant like the ruins of a very old unknown civilization, you're going to put the scientific community on their ear and change a lot of people's perspective about the past. Are you ready for that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for God's sake, that nothing would excite me more. You know, I would love to be able to have the scientific community go out there and go, oh my God, look at that. Must have been the same feeling that the scientific community felt when Gordon found the Olmec civilization, that went back 7,500 years ago, or maybe even more, that nobody even knew about prior to 1969. How about that? You know,
some people are rejoiced. Others are treated very poorly because it shakes up our notions of our past. And so I ask that somewhat jokingly, but I also ask it in a serious manner because people's careers have been ruined by changing the dynamics of our history.
Well, it must have been the same thing that happened when, okay, if you went back to the time of the Greeks and you were a Greek living in Athens and there Zeus and Athena and Venus, and you were a firm believer and you were just a devout mythology lover,
right?
Whatever their gods are called. And then you fast forward 1,500 years and you go, oh my God, that was really dumb. They actually believed that Athena was the goddess of love and Venus, the goddess of wisdom, and Zeus and all these Tritons and things. How ridiculous is that? Well, you know, how ridiculous is it to they, at some point in time, there's a turning point in people's beliefs of how what our origins are really about. And it just takes the discovery of those for people to change their minds. And people don't like to make change. There's a lot of people who don't want to change, don't want to know, and would rather bury their heads in the sand. Well, I'm not one of those people.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Hey, last question, and hopefully you can help us out. Is there any new photos you can send our way? I can put up on the Facebook page for our listening audience to take a look of look at that haven't been published yet. Maybe a couple of unique shots.
I have to look into that, Cliff, because I got a bunch of guys that work with me and we're trying to keep this under wraps. And it's kind of like so soon to give out too much detail. And I really appreciate what you're asking. And I know what you're going for. And I ask everybody just to be patient and wait till we come back. But I'll see what I can do.
OK.
I can't promise anything, but I can try.
OK, Daryl, this has been great. This has been our first part one of our discovery. Of your discovery, I should say, and telling us a little bit about what you found. And I look forward to speaking with you again shortly to talk about part two.
Fantastic. Thank you, Cliff.
I have a new series of photographs I am going to put up on the Facebook page. It will go to the .com, earthancients.com, but Facebook is quicker, easier, and it's really the way to go at this point. So, and also next week, Miklos will be sending me some brand new photos taken off a series of videos that were taken underwater that I think you'll find interesting. Next week's part two of this dive, and I think you are going to want to come back and listen simply because what is discovered, all I can say, it's groundbreaking. It's pretty significant. He will be going back to that location next March, and he promises to send more information. We'll probably have a follow-up interview with him and perhaps one or two of the producers of Cooper's Treasure, although this is not going to be featured on Cooper's Treasure. This new dive is an independent dive that he is funding himself, and we'll hear the details of that again next week. If you enjoyed the program, please consider becoming a Patreon member, a subscriber of Earth Ancients. It does take effort. It takes funding to put on each show. And your subscriptions to Patreon really help. For as little as $5 a month, you support the work we do here at Earth Ancients. And also, we have a lot of really cool presents and gifts as a subscriber. We have a lot of ebooks. We have unedited, unposted interviews. We have music. We have galleries. And we have Cliff Notes. This is a new program we just started this month. Our first program will be next week. This is a chance to speak with me, speak with some special guests that we have. Some of them will be on the program. But, you know, we can talk. We can talk about what's coming up, what you're interested in. Some of the questions you have, and some of them we can answer, some of them we can't. But check it out. Cliff Notes on Patreon. You have to be a Patreon member to take that up, take it in, and check it out. Patreon is patreon.com/earthancients. Okay, that's it for this show. And next week, we'll get back to our regular program. Melissa Tittle, Adam Young will be joining us again, but today is we wanted to do a special presentation, an exclusive interview with Miklos, with Daryl Miklos, and what he discovered. Okay, we will talk to you next week.
The Seven Ages Research Associates are a team whose shared interest in history, archaeology, science, and culture brings us to fascinating places, and we want you to join us on the adventure of exploring our ancient past.
We seem to be still willing to ignore vast chunks of what we understand or should understand to be the case.
I'm trying to prove something's here and that's important. If I can get that done, I will have done my job.
I'm James Waldo. My interest in geology really got started in the military stationed up in the Pacific Northwest.
I'm Jason Pentrell, environmental scientist for the Seven Ages team. Archaeology, anthropology, the peopling of Americas, and all those type of things only fueled that interest.
My name's Micah Hanks. I'm a writer and a researcher. I love history, and I think we've got a lot of questions that remain unanswered about the ancient past.
I think we need to, you know, be very careful to not impose our viewpoints onto the past and instead to let the people of the past speak through the archaeological record.
We are the Seven Ages Research Associates. Visit us online at sevenages.org for videos, podcasts, articles, and much more.